Think for a moment about how often you read. From signs on the road to articles on your computer screen, even to tiny matchboxes, reading permeates everything in our experience. But to the surprisingly large segment of the population that suffers from dyslexia, learning to read and spell can be a significant struggle. I'm Matthew Law Middleton, and on today's Central Standard, we'll be exploring what dyslexia actually is, how it impacts learning, and the various coping strategies and educational models that can turn this disability into an asset. Later in the hour, we'll be exploring the potential impacts of increasing the highway speed limit in Missouri. A bill in the legislature this session could make Illinois eat our dust. That's all coming up right after this news. Your child begins school. Kindergarten is going well. Your child is bright, engaged, making friends and learning. But in the first grade, your child returns home frustrated and upset. Reading, writing, and spelling are not just hard, but they're a significant challenge, and in a way that other learning has not been. For a great number of people, including myself, who suffer from dyslexia, this story can be extremely familiar, and the impacts of this disability can play out across a person's life. Good morning, I'm Matthew Law Middleton, and on today's Central Standard, we're going to be exploring dyslexia, the ins and outs of this disability, and the kind of supports needed to overcome it. Joining us to discuss dyslexia is Pam Taylor. She's the director of Lexibility, a group that provides screening and remediation services to dyslexic children. Good morning, Pam.
Good morning. Thank you for having me, Matthew.
You're welcome. And so I think the most basic question is, what exactly is dyslexia?
Well, dyslexia is a brain difference. And a lot of people try and call dyslexia a disability or to pathologically define it. But really, it's a brain difference. And it's a brain difference that exists in 1/5 of our population. So that means 20% of Americans have dyslexia. And the brain difference is neurobiological in origin, which means that we're born with this brain difference. And the difference affects our brains in both gross and fine anatomy. So in gross anatomy, it means that our right hemisphere of our brain is actually a little bit larger than those without dyslexia. The connections between the two hemispheres are shaped a little bit differently, and the part of our brain which does language processing that's involved in reading is structured differently, and it's not as efficient as those that don't have dyslexia.
Where in the brain does typically the language process of the brain, where is that located, and how is it different?
Well, reading's very complicated, and it's a global brain effort. There are about 13 processing areas in the brain that we identify on functional MRIs. But the areas that we specifically identify for dyslexia are pretty much on the left side of the brain.
And so there's a difference on the left side compared to the 80% of the other population, roughly.
Absolutely. There are three areas involved in the left side of the brain. One's called Broca's area, and that's where we intake words, the Wernicke's area, which is located on the left side of your brain, kind of in the middle. Mm-hmm. And then there's the occipital temporal lobe. And this process, these three areas of the brain
On the left-hand side
need to form an efficient connection in order for reading to be automatic and fluent. Those with dyslexia are born with less efficient neural connections than those without dyslexia.
And when you say efficiency, you're talking about like the you can watch in an MRI, like in a functional MRI, mm-hmm. the rate of energy being consumed by the brain. So on the left hemisphere, you would see actually a lot more energy being expended to do the same process, and that would indicate like an inefficiency in energy consumption, essentially? Is that what we mean, or something entirely different?
It's a little bit different. What we see with typical readers is the fMRIs light up quite efficiently for reading on the left side of the brain between those three areas. But what happens in people with dyslexia is we see actually areas on the back of the brain and the right side of the brain lighting up, because people with dyslexia do learn to read, but they learn to read using different parts of the brain, which aren't as efficient as the language processing that typical readers use.
And so how similar or different is this to other forms of learning disabilities, auditory processing disabilities, or dysgraphia, which is slightly different. But how is it different or similar?
Well, the brain difference that manifests as dyslexia also manifests in different kinds of issues, and they're often what we call comorbid conditions. So along with dyslexia, we also see issues of dysgraphia, which are issues with penmanship. We also see issues of dyscalculia, which are issues with number sense. Issues also with sequencing arbitrary information, like learning phone numbers and addresses and even the sequence of the alphabet, and also memorizing things like multiplication tables and addition and subtraction facts.
So you just mentioned like a lot of different things
right.
that could be impacted. So not everybody who is dyslexic will present the same exact symptoms. Is it
Bingo.
more of a spectrum then?
It's a huge spectrum because if you think about it, 1 in 5 people has this brain difference. So dyslexia is a huge spectrum that manifests in all sorts of different ways and all sorts of different degrees. So we have people who are mildly dyslexic that get through life just fine. It's just a blip on the radar. They compensate and it's done. And then we have people that have more severe, profound dyslexia that continue to be affected by these ways, which are pretty significant. Significant because culturally, those types of skills that require that language processing are really important to us.
Mm-hmm. And when did we discover dyslexia? I assume it didn't just pop out of nowhere, but our understanding of it did.
Right. Dyslexia is actually, we've actually suspected dyslexia for many, many years. And in 80 years ago, Dr. Orton and Anna Gillingham recognized it. They called it something different. But the National Institutes of Health has been very aggressively studying dyslexia since the 70s. Mm-hmm. So,
And what determines the severity of dyslexia? Is it totally random chance? Where on that spectrum you fall?
That's an excellent question, and I don't really think that we have that answer quite yet. We mm-hmm. do know that it's not neurobiological, so it's inherited. And for example, in my own family, I have a father that's severely dyslexic. I'm very mildly dyslexic, and I have a child that's severely dyslexic. Mm-hmm. So it exists, and it changes from generation to generation.
Correlations between race, sex, income, like...
No, it's not. And that's an excellent question. Dyslexia is pretty equal opportunity. And mm-hmm. it exists in all cultures. We do know that there is an Inuit tribe that has a higher prevalence of dyslexia. And we think that's because the gene pool is so isolated. But dyslexia is everywhere. The brain difference that causes dyslexia is everywhere. But in America, we believe it's 20%. And a lot of that has to do with our language and how we try to identify dyslexia as a pathological issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I want to get to that a little because you were saying, we don't necessarily want to identify it as a disability. But on the other hand, by identifying it as a disability, it affords us legal protections or individuals who suffer from dyslexia, legal protections in terms of their education because of the Americans with Disabilities Act. So where are you coming at with that distinction?
Well, as a clinician and as a parent, I really hate to diagnose dyslexia. Dyslexia, because it does make it sound like it's a disease, but the brain difference that causes these problems also comes with all sorts of incredible strengths.
For example?
For example, creativity, visual spatial awareness, mechanical ability, physical abilities, artistic and musical abilities, and all sorts of narrative and different kinds of reasoning that we see in successful people in our culture.
Mm-hmm. And there are a number of other learning disabilities, and I think about the advancements in modern science that have given us medications, for example, for ADD, ADHD.
Right.
But there is no drug that helps account for these inefficiencies in the brain for dyslexia, correct?
No, and I don't really know that we need to account for those inefficiencies because what science tells us is that if we identify children with dyslexia early and provide the proper intervention, 95% of all reading failure is preventable.
Where do we come up with that number?
The National Institutes of Health.
So, it seems like a hard number to kind of measure. What do we mean by preventability? Like, it just, there wasn't enough intervention at the right time?
Right, because what our current curriculums, our standard education assumes is, one, that all children can and should learn the same way, and two, that reading's pretty intuitive. Well, language, speaking is very natural, but reading is a very, very complicated neurological exercise. And with our reading instruction, we kind of leap over all sorts of stuff when we start teaching reading to kids. And one of them is phonemic awareness. And when kids don't have phonemic awareness, they don't understand phonics.
What is phonemic awareness?
Phonemic awareness, great question. Phonemic awareness is the ability to manipulate the smallest parts of speech. So, for example, when I say the word cat, that actually contains three phonemes, k, a, t. And kids with dyslexia have a really hard time discerning those and processing those.
But most people with dyslexia don't have a difficult time, like, speaking.
Right.
That seems like a kind of weird disconnect to me. Like, if you can hear it and say it correctly, well, like, why is that connection so difficult?
Actually, people with dyslexia do have problems with speech, and we can identify those very early. One of the first symptoms of dyslexia is actually delayed speaking. When a child is not using 10 to 15 words by their first birthday, it's a really good sign that we need to watch for them with dyslexia. When we have little kids that mix up their R's and their L's and their W's and have a hard time hearing the difference.
Like whale woad,
yeah.
For example.
Or Baba Walpush.
Yeah.
Right. So when we have kids that have issues with that, we need to pay attention. Or even things like mixing up syllables, like kids that say simonym and iron and hecalopter and aluminum and
see, aluminum. That just sounds adorable, but...
It does. It sounds totally adorable. And so we dismiss it. We say, oh, isn't that so cute?
And isn't that a process of like learning language? I think that that's also something
it
we
is,
can assume.
It is, but kids with dyslexia are pretty persistent about it.
Mm-hmm. And so you mentioned that, you know, we estimate that maybe about 20% of people have dyslexia in our population, but I also assume it's a little underreported as well.
It's hugely underreported, and I have a great illustration for that. If we have 100,000 people in a stadium, 20,000 will have dyslexia, but only 2,000 of them will be identified as struggling readers. And they usually have to be failing pretty significantly to be identified. And of those, we estimate that only 200 would ever be diagnosed officially with dyslexia. So that's 200 out of 20,000. That's a horrible diagnostic rate.
Mm. You're listening to KCUR Central Standard on 89.3 FM. Streaming live on KCUR.org, I'm Matthew Long Milton, and our guest is Pam Taylor. She's the director of Lexi Ability. We're discussing the learning disability dyslexia. Do you or your child have dyslexia? What have been your greatest challenges, and how have you overcome them? Join the conversation by calling 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888, or email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. So, Pam, what are some of the initial signs? You mentioned just one already, low vocabulary within the first year even. But what are some of those initial signs that your child or you may have dyslexia?
Well, one of the first things that I listen to as a screening specialist is when I have a parent come to me and say, I have a bright child and he's struggling or she's struggling in unexpected ways. So when we have a child, for example, in kindergarten that's resistant to learning the alphabet or learning how to read, or kids that really write well on one paper, but their next paper, their product is diminished. So we look for inconsistencies. That's a big... Big sign. The other things that we look for is an inability to work with the letters of the alphabet make. And
Like vowels may, I mean, we have what, five to seven vowels,
right?
But they make up over 20 different sounds depending on the context of the consonants around them.
Exactly. We have hundreds of spelling patterns in English, and we also have everything, lots of rules for what we call arbitrary sounds. And they're, most people that are typical readers kind of intuitively grasp this. It's very easy, and once they see it, get it, process it, it's done. But with kids with dyslexia, you have to teach them every kind of logical sequence that applies to that arbitrary sound.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to go to the calls here. Dee from Overland Park. Dee, welcome to Central Standard.
Thank you. Good to be on the show.
Yeah, good, great. I understand you have a question about your child.
Yeah, I have a kindergartner who, yeah, like you have been mentioning, is very bright and just doesn't, the only thing he doesn't do, consistently he writes his letters in mirror. So I don't know, I understand that there's sometimes reversals of letters that's just common for kids, but like his name, he'll write it perfectly reversed where in a mirror you hold it up and it's his name, but obviously it's reversed on paper. Is that a sign of dyslexia?
It can be.
Sign?
It can be. Now, letter reversals are quite common until the end of first grade. And at the end of first grade, we really want to see letter reversals quite diminished. Mirror writing is something that can indicate dyslexia because it's issues of what we call directionality. And that's something we look for in kids. So, and that's why the letter reversals happen. It's not because we see it differently. It's because we process it differently. So you'll see kids confuse B's and D's and P's and Q's because they're all a ball with a stick on it facing a different direction. The mirror writing, though, when we see that, we do pay attention. But I think there's some controversy about whether or not that's an actual sign of dyslexia.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, Dee, thank you.
Thank you, Dee.
And so you mentioned some of those earlier signs, but let's assume that, you know, you don't catch it at, you know, by, you know,
right,
kindergarten, and a person has entered essentially the school system.
Right.
You know, what are some things we should be looking for by, you know, first, second grade and
well, when we have resistant or reluctant readers, when we have kids that are struggling with learning their addition and subtraction facts, you know, the kids that keep doing the little number tricks under the tables, when we have kids that read, when they read out loud, it's stilted or slow or choppy. But the other thing that we look for is spelling. Mm-hmm. And when kids have difficulty using phonetic or inventive spelling in first and second grade, when they're dropping vowels, when they're dropping consonants, when what they're doing is something that's almost uninterpretable, we need to be paying attention.
Mm-hmm. And so what are some of those first things that we should be doing? So I noticed these things similar to D, you know, I have a little bit of concern. Who do I turn to first? Where do I go?
Well, that's a good question, and the answer that I have for that is not very encouraging. Basically, the helpers that we depend on to identify dyslexia have no training or experience to do so.
For dyslexia specifically.
For dyslexia specifically. It's not offered in our graduate programs or our doctorate programs or our undergraduate programs. It's something that you have to find somebody that has specifically sought that out. Hmm. Special education teachers, reading specialists, psychologists, school psychologists, speech pathologists do not receive training in dyslexia identification in their schooling.
It's specifically in
that,
but
right,
they are trained, of course, in like assessing learning disabilities
right,
in general.
Right. And that's good. I mean, we need to, you know, like a basic psychoeducational evaluation can help suss out other things other than dyslexia, and it can also help confirm dyslexia. But that whole evaluation only delves into dyslexia for a few minutes. And we what we know about dyslexia is it's very tricky to assess. So we actually need a complete battery of tests that specifically dwell down on that.
I remember when I was a child, I was assessed in the public school education system in Massachusetts, where I grew up.
Mm-hmm.
But my parents wanted another consultation and Children's Hospital in Boston. They had a really, really good program there.
They do.
And so we went there to a hospital, and it was a very long, extensive test. Can you explain some of the details of that test, like what else people are looking for that maybe public schools or the primary education system doesn't do?
Well, you know, a lot of schools screen for dyslexia using reading tests, and reading is actually the least predictive. What a screening battery needs to include is a test for phonological awareness, and that helps us discern whether or not a kid's having problems with phonemes. It also needs to be included in a battery that assesses a child's ability to read words in isolation, because when bright kids don't know how to read, they make it up. So we have kids with dyslexia that can read quite well, up to a point. We usually see about fourth grade these kids really starting to struggle. And the battery would also include, in addition to standardized tests that assess phonology, they would and other tests that test reading ability, we want to make sure that these kids can phonetically read. So we have to, that screening battery has to include nonsense words, words that they haven't seen before.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think Sarah has a question here from the phones. Sarah in Stillwell, welcome to Central Standard.
How do you do? Thank you so much for covering this program today. I'm sitting here quite stunned because everything I've just heard describes my son to a T, and I've always suspected it. However, I've tried to speak to teachers. He does go to a reading specialist who has her master's in teaching reading. He's been seeing her since kindergarten. He's now 7 in second grade. Seems to be getting all the help he needs, yet nobody seems to know anything about dyslexia. I've Googled on where to go in the Kansas City area, in the Kansas area, anywhere, and I don't know where to begin or where to start. And I know the last caller also asked about that. Is it our pediatrician? Where should we go?
Well, our pediatricians, medical doctors don't receive any training in dyslexia. And I opened a clinic in Kansas City because I am someone with dyslexia, and I have three children with dyslexia, and I kind of got sick of complaining about how there were no resources. So I did open up the clinic. There are a few good clinics here in Kansas City, but there's not enough of us to help meet the need.
One of the things I think I've noticed, is there like a regional difference in terms of the focus on dyslexia? Like, do the coasts have a lot more research and money put towards this, or is this just a problem across the board?
It's pretty much a problem across the board. However, in the area, the Baltimore area, there's a lot of help because that's where the International Dyslexia Association is, and they have some great schools. So on the East Coast, there are a few more resources, but we're talking about schools that charge tens of thousands of dollars in tuition every single year. Mm-hmm. So, no, it's pretty much a problem across the board.
Mm-hmm. And so what happens when your child, let's assume that you go through the testing process, if I remember correctly, like the way the diagnosis is made is like a significant divergence in performance. Like, for example, really high long-term memory and really, really low test results on short-term memory, for example.
That's using a discrepancy model, which we have been directed to no longer use, but most of the school districts in the Kansas City area do still use the discrepancy model.
Why the change, and what's better?
Well, we know that intellect isn't tied to reading ability that's related to dyslexia. So we know that we don't assess kids to see if there's a huge disparity between, I mean, I think it can help us identify kids, but that discrepancy has to be so huge that millions and millions of kids get left out.
Mm-hmm. So what now is the best practices for assessing dyslexia?
Well, in assessing for dyslexia, it's using a dyslexia screening battery. That's what we use, the CTOP and everything I discussed before. Mm. From there on, after we have, but you know what? This is what I'm going to say that's a little unconventional. Most parents are right.
Yeah.
If they suspect their kid has dyslexia, they probably have. And I always know when a parent finds me that their kid probably has dyslexia because they've looked enough to find me.
Do you find that it's usually the parent who comes to you, or do the parents tell a story that they're the ones who are suspicious, or is it also the student who's suspicious that something is not, going
the way it
should be?
It's almost always the parent that's come to me after they've gone to the school several times. Mm-hmm. They've asked the school and they've been told, we can't assess for dyslexia until third grade, which isn't true. Or we don't believe in dyslexia, or we don't have the resources to deal with dyslexia. So they basically kind of are in this holding pattern for a while, and then something random happens and they get my name from somebody and they call me up and they say, it's probably not this, but I just want to make sure. And it almost always is dyslexia.
And so if you get the diagnosis, it now becomes like essentially a legal document, a documentation of a disability. So what happens next when you're in the public school system or even a private school system?
Well, I find the diagnosis is not helpful at all. And that's why I don't buy into the whole idea that we diagnose dyslexia. First of all, I don't believe it's pathological. I have a whole clinic worth of kids that are intellectually brilliant and very, very gifted. They struggle specifically with a skill. So I don't believe in diagnosing dyslexia, but a lot of people out there say, yes, let's call it a disability because it affords us legal recourse. Great. I could get all behind that if, one, we were better at identifying those kids, not the 200 out of the 20,000. And two, if we actually provided the right services for those kids. Science has told us the same thing for the past, since the 70s, if not before, that we know that there's one methodology that specifically works for kids with dyslexia, and the schools around here don't offer it.
Well, what is that? It sounds like you have this magic bullet.
It's not a magic bullet. It's a very specific program that takes a very long time on working with a student one-to-one, and it's called Orton-Gillingham. Mm. Orton-Gillingham is what we call a multi-sensory program. It engages many senses, the auditory, the tactile, the kinesthetic, all at the same time. And it's not just how it's taught, but it's also what is taught. And we don't have a really intuitive understanding of language processing, so it has to be taught in a very slow, systematic, cumulative, and logical way based on the probabilities and rules of spelling. And schools do not have the resources to do that. There's no school system in the United States that has the resources to offer up one-on-one instruction for 20% of their students.
Why does it have to be one-on-one? What's behind that? Why can't it be like 1-to-5 ratio?
Because you have to discern, you have to help these kids discern the smallest parts of speech. It requires an exactness and an experience that it's just, I can tell you, in working with small groups with kids that have dyslexia, if you have a small group of 2 or 3 kids, it takes 2 or 3 times as long.
Because you're assessing, you're helping each student through their very particular phonetic difficulties.
It's called diagnostic teaching, which means you work with a student and you have to continually flex with them based on their ability, and not just their overall ability, but their ability in that given moment. So you're continually changing course to meet those needs.
Well, I want to get to Emily here. Emily in Leawood, welcome to Central Standard.
Oh, thank you very much.
Hi, Emily.
I'm so glad that somebody is doing this topic.
Oh, well, thank you. What would you like to add to the conversation?
Well, I have a child that has been diagnosed with phonemic awareness disorder before the dyslexia. And fortunately for us, at the time, my husband was in the military, and we had moved to a different state. We were previously stationed in Indiana, where I took my child to a public school system because I knew he was having trouble learning, and I was homeschooling at the time. They threw their hands up in the air and didn't offer me anything. We were fortunately moved to North Dakota, and I went to the university there at Minot State. They had a specific communications and learning disorder clinic, and they helped me and gave me hope and told me that my child had a brain processing order, like you said, and it was just very helpful. And now that we have moved to Kansas, he is in public school, but for middle school, which he hits next year, I am pulling him out and homeschooling him because the curriculum does engage him in all of these senses. And we noticed that when he was bouncing on a trampoline or laying upside down, his reading fluency would be greater.
Really? That's so fascinating. And you mentioned, so you went to a clinic to help get this diagnosis more firm. And was that an out-of-pocket expense for you then?
It was a mild one, but because we had a physician's order, our insurance company picked it up. And so I just had a copay. But it was very expensive. I saw the bill.
Yeah. Anything to add to that, Pam?
Well, I missed what you said about what he was diagnosed with in addition to dyslexia.
Phonemic awareness disorder.
Oh, phonemic. Was it phonemic?
Phonemic, yes.
Okay,
phonemic
yes. Phonemic awareness is, that is dyslexia. So anyway, I just wanted to clarify that. But it is very, very difficult to get a diagnosis. But there are some great schools around that do offer those services. And it's extremely expensive. We know to get a psychoeducational evaluation, typically in the Kansas City area, it can run $1,200 to $2,500.
If you can't get that covered by insurance.
Right. And then not only that, but psychologists, if they have the training to screen specifically for dyslexia, the DSM-5, the APA, basically says that we have to look for diagnostic certainty for diagnosis. And the diagnostic certainty that the APA suggests for dyslexia is below 7%. That means a child has to be profoundly struggling before a psychologist can diagnose with certainty.
And I suspect that one of the dangers of that is that by the time someone is struggling that far, it could be the third or fourth, fifth grade. And so by that time, you've lost all this really important groundwork time to help begin to cope for this disability.
Exactly. We essentially learn to read from about kindergarten to third grade, but starting at fourth grade, we're reading to learn. And that's why we often identify kids that have really good coping skills much later. And they, we started out in school just fine. They were great readers. They love to read. But then in fourth grade, you notice that they're not progressing with their peers. They're not reading. They might be reading at grade level, but they're not reading at their intellectual level. They start reading the same books over and over again. Mm-hmm. Then multiplication tables hit and they really start to struggle with memorizing those, and then the problems, they just start becoming compounding and confounding.
Well, I really want to move the conversation to adults. We have a full board of calls about this. So let's assume that you've gotten some of the support you've needed, and okay. you've developed coping mechanisms.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I'm curious about is, you know, when you get into the workplace, what do you do with your disability? Do you disclose to your employer?
Most people choose not to. I mean, there are legal recourses for disabilities, but one, dyslexia is very, very difficult to diagnose. So very few of us get the diagnosis we need for that legal recourse. And two, the information about dyslexia, the misinformation and the myths are so prevailing that there's quite a stigma with it. So we don't actually always encourage disclosure in the workplace. Of course, that's going to be on a case-by-case basis.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have a call here from Jen in Lenexa. Jen, welcome to Central Standard.
Thank you very much.
Hi, Jen.
What is your question or comment for us today?
My question is, my husband is in his 40s. He was diagnosed very late in high school, so he never had any, was never taught any of the techniques and things that could help him. And I've looked for resources for adults, and I have not found anything. And I wonder if there is anything in the area.
There aren't specific resources for adults in Kansas City. We do have a support group that meets once a month. Adults usually what we find with dyslexia is that it makes school really difficult to endure, but we find ways to cope with it outside of school. So we don't tend to find the same kind of issues or needs for support. But there are things that we encourage adults to, there's different types of accommodations we do encourage adults to access. One of them that's extremely important is audiobooks, and then the other one is dictation software. Those can make all the difference in the world.
Jen, thank you for your call. And to take a step back for a moment, requirement of a lot of people is to take a foreign language, particularly when they get into high school
right.
and or college. Do we find that the disability becomes even greater there, or do they have different talents when it comes to foreign languages, or should it be something you just avoid altogether?
You know, everybody's different, and I have some kids with dyslexia that love foreign language because they've picked a very phonetic-based language, so it's actually a little bit easier for them to grasp onto.
For example, which language?
Spanish. Mm-hmm. But it's still extremely difficult for most of us. I've been taking Spanish for 40 years, and I still don't. I still haven't grasped it at all, and I think I'm pretty typical. So what we suggest is that for kids that have dyslexia, when they have language requirements, we encourage them to take American Sign Language, which will fulfill that requirement for most colleges and universities.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that there's a lot of research. There is research being done into dyslexia and how to treat it, and one of the methods you mentioned earlier. What else are we learning, you know, continually about this brain difference?
Well, what we're learning is, one of the big things that's come out in the past couple of years is this definitive answer that dyslexia is not tied to intellect, which is a big reason why we don't use we encourage not using the discrepancy model anymore.
Mm-hmm.
There's some really exciting neurological work that's coming out of Haskins Laboratory in Connecticut. A doctor, Fumiko Hoft, has been doing some fMRI imaging of really gifted kids that have dyslexia. And she's been comparing those brain scans of children that have profound dyslexia and have found that even though they're above average readers, they are still struggling significantly. So what that tells us is that even for kids that are compensating quite well, they still need help. We can still make things better for them.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to go to the phones here. Michelle from Olathe. Welcome to Central Standard.
Hi, Michelle.
Good morning.
Morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Doing well. What's your question or comment?
Well, actually, I was going to make a comment on just kind of a support to parents who do have kids that are screened and being dyslexic. That's kind of I'm a business owner, employ plenty of people, and kind of a dyslexic success story. I was diagnosed really late. I was diagnosed actually in eighth grade. I literally couldn't read until eighth grade, and I had a great English teacher that went, "Here's a bright kid, something's not quite right." And this was in the 80s. So I consider myself very lucky that somebody caught it.
You are.
So there's kind of an ongoing joke in the business support groups that I do, that you walk into a room with a bunch of entrepreneurs, ask them how many are dyslexic, and everybody will raise their hand.
and there are studies out there that say that we believe that 35% of successful entrepreneurs have dyslexia, which is a much higher prevailing rate than the general population. So you're onto something there.
Michelle?
Yeah, you know, and I kind of think of my dyslexia as more of it's my superhero power, you know?
I do too.
If I didn't have this, imagine what I would be doing.
What do you think it is what do you think that has given you that other people miss out on?
Well, I think that people with dyslexia find very creative ways to problem solve. You know, once I was, I made it through eighth grade fooling everybody that I was on top of it. So I really figured out how to problem solve my schoolwork. And you'll find that I think a lot of these adults who are in creative problem solving fields really do have some, shades of dyslexia that follow them. And not only that, I kind of disagree with letting other people know that you have this, because I have no pride. If I have to write a paper or something, I hand it to three other people to proofread.
Right. And go, I do that as well.
You know, Microsoft, spell check is like the worst thing for a dyslexic person. It comes up with, we have no idea what you're trying to spell, come up with something else. So I let the people around me know, but where I lack in this, I excel in other things.
Right. And I think people with dyslexia, they tend to choose careers and tend to work in places where people are understanding of that, or where that type of writing is in a huge requirement of the job. I would like to be able to tell everybody, but what we know is that about 80% of teachers actually think that dyslexia is a form of mental retardation.
No.
Yeah. Wow. Headstrong Nation.
Yeah. Well, Michelle, thank you so much for your call. We're going to go to a quick break, but Pam Taylor, thank you so much for joining us. She's the director of Lexiability, and you can find more information about her and her organization at kcur.org. Thank you so much, Pam,
for joining
us.
Thank you so much, Matthew.
And when we come back, we'll have more on a piece of legislation that's making its way through the Missouri legislature to increase the speed limit in Missouri. Central Standard returns in just a moment.